Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. All right, I'm going to send you to the deep end of the pool today. We have invited David Labson, who is a professor of economics at Harvard, and he has studied and taught and researched on a lot of really interesting areas. At least I hope it's interesting to you. It's very interesting to me. Behavioral economics, why we do what we do with our money and things of economy, neuroeconomics, a whole long list of things that I'm not even sure what some of these are. They're out there, and he's on the cutting edge. So I'd like to welcome David to the program. Welcome, David. How are you today?
I'm great.
Outstanding.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. You know, in doing the work I do, there's a lot of behavior as it relates to financial planning and also with investing, of course, why people do what they do with their money. And so we wanted to invite you on to give us some of your expertise and insight into finances and as it relates to, you know, the decisions people make. And then also, I know one particular area of interest and research for you has to do with 401k plans and how employees participate. So I think my local business owners will be interested to hear about that. Anything else about your research, kind of some of the things you've done that would be good for our listeners to hear before we get into some of those subjects?
Well, another big topic that I tend to think about is fees for financial services.
Very good.
And how insensitive we are and how if we focused a lot more on those fees, we'd have a lot more to retire on.
Well, that's well said, and I'll add that to my list of things I'd like for us to touch on, because my background, I started as a CPA before I became a financial planner, and I'm still a CPA, but fees have always been very important to everything I do when I look at this. All right, so you are a professor at Harvard. What's your day like?
It's a mess. So
okay.
Usually start in the morning with the conference call, 8 a.m. Eventually, I'll make my way to a classroom, undergrads, graduate students.
Okay.
Sometimes lecture, sometimes listen to my doctoral students and their research projects, maybe some office hours, some committee meetings, some research meetings, a little tiny bit of time to actually think in peace in my office, very little, and then home for dinner with my six-year-old.
Oh, very good, very good. So this area of, in a nutshell, if you can, describe for our listeners, what is behavioral economics first all about?
So it takes traditional economics, and it adds a little psychology to make the traditional rational actor model more realistic. So the psychology might be imperfect reasoning, imperfect rationality, imperfect knowledge, imperfect logic, or maybe a self-control problem. Someone who knows what they should do, has the right intentions, has the right instincts, but can't act on them. So someone who thinks they're going to enroll in their 401k plan, just not this week, I'll do it tomorrow, next week, and years go by and they keep postponing. So all of those psychological ingredients get mixed in.
Okay, so it's kind of a recipe for how we do what we do about our money.
Exactly.
Okay, and I know the topic, one of the things we wanted to use really as a good example and a way of discussing some of these behavioral economic concepts and different parts of that is the person who works for a company has access to a 401k plan and how they choose to participate in that plan. And of course, the underlying logic here, of course, is that everybody knows, or most people know, that if you're working and you're trying to build toward retirement, you can't work the rest of your life. At some point, you will be physically unable or you'll be asked to stop by the employer, that you need to have money set aside. And so the 401k plan, of course, allows people to have that opportunity. So you've done a real lot of research in this area. What have you learned and what can you share with us about people's decision making in that area?
I think the most important lesson is that people are very passive. So that if you are a new employee at a firm and the firm has a retirement savings plan and it's up to the employee to opt in, they won't, or they'll take years to do so. So the first thing is that employers should automatically enroll their employees, not in a unwelcome way. If the employee doesn't like it, they can opt out. It turns out that when the employer automatically enrolls employees, 90-95% of the employees stick. Whereas if the employer doesn't automatically enroll the new employee and the employee has to take the initiative and opt in, after a year of employment, only 30-40% of the employees will be saving. So automatic enrollment has been the breakthrough in this industry, and there's many other auto features that have also helped people overcome their passivity. We can talk about auto escalation. We can talk about the target date funds, which automatically move people from a equity allocation when young towards a more and more heavy bond allocation as they age. All of these auto features are transforming the landscape and helping people who would otherwise be passive and do nothing to become successful savers.
Excellent. Well, we're going to do all that. Those are some perfect things to add to our conversation. We have David Lapson, who is a professor of economics with Harvard. A quick website I'll give to them, David, that they can go and get more information about you. They can do that at Harvard's website. It's scholar.harvard.edu, and it's /Lapson, Laibson. That'll be available to them. They can go and get more information. David, let's take a quick break. We'll come right back. Listeners, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Did you know living longer could be the death of your retirement? According to the U.S. Census Bureau, babies born today can expect to live until an average age of 78. Whether you're retiring today, tomorrow, or in 20 years, you must ask yourself, will your retirement plan go the distance? Holland Financial is ready to help. Call 888-747-PLAN to schedule your free consultation or visit us at davidholland.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. David Lapson, a professor of economics from Harvard, is on the line with us, and we're talking about behavioral economics, which is, in plain English, how and why we do what we do with our money or anything that's an economic decision. And we're talking a little bit about 401ks, the way people participate, and some of the lessons or important things that the research that David has done about 401ks. And you mentioned the auto-enrollment, which I have seen, and I've been working with clients a long time, David, and I've also done some work with employers with 401ks, and the automatic enrollment, of course, has been a big thing, not only for the employees and for the plan sponsors themselves, but of course, the entire industry welcomes that because that puts more money into these plans, and of course, the providers want that to happen as well.
Yeah, that was a two-edged sword, because a lot of these default contribution rates are very low. 2 or 3% is typical. So in fact, the way it's been rolled out to date has been a bit of a disappointment.
Well, that's what's interesting, because you mentioned before the break, and I was going to ask you about this, because I read in some of your work, you talk about the fact that, yes, they will stick with it, and 90% that will stick with those initial selections. They don't really change the investments that much, but they stick with that, maybe that initial low auto-enrollment. And the way of maybe addressing that is something you mentioned before the break, the auto-escalation. Talk about how that works.
So there's two ways to address it. One is just to pick a higher default contribution rate.
Sure.
So rather than auto-enrolling people at a 2 or 3% contribution rate, we can auto-enroll them at a 6% contribution rate. And in our work, we find that the same opt-out rate applies, meaning if 10% opt out at a 3% contribution rate, likewise, about 10% opt out at a 6% contribution rate.
And you know, that seems counterintuitive, because you think of that would create a greater likelihood that people say, oh my gosh, I can't afford 6, I'm going to opt out.
Yeah, but these are small differences between 3 and 6%. You know, it's not a night and day difference for almost all American households. And American households want to save. Now, there's another strategy, which is what you mentioned a minute ago, auto-escalation. And that comes in many forms. The typical version is that every year the savings rate ticks up another percentage point. So if you come in at 3, it goes to 4, 5, 6, 7, maybe it caps out at 10.
Until you cry uncle, right?
No. Some of them work that way, but most of them cap out.
Right.
So there's a preset cap by the employer, and then it stops. They know that most people don't need a 30% savings
rate.
That makes sense. Some of us do, but most of us don't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think a lot of us need to be there. But so it is, again, it is interesting that it doesn't shut down. So, and then people stick with it. They pretty much stick with it because their lifestyle adjusts to the cash in the bank account.
Exactly. I mean, they're getting raises every year, so the raises are sort of being offset in a typical economy. I mean, this economy is not typical right now, but usually people are getting an increase every year, even an increase when you adjust for inflation. So the uptick in the savings rate is just eating away at the annual raises, and consequently, they don't feel the pain.
Okay. And then the path of least resistance, that seems to be an underlying message here, that they're going to go with what is the easiest thing, because technology has not necessarily made our lives so much easier and freed up all this extra leisure time. The amount of activity seems to take up the amount of available time.
Yeah, and we just have the natural psychology of wanting to do the hard work tomorrow. I mean, even when you've got time on your hands, you'll be sitting in front of a television set rather than scrubbing the bathroom floor. So the tough stuff we want to postpone, and the path of least resistance is doing what is the least unpleasant right now, or the most pleasant right now. Consequently, we need to help people.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's what I do a lot of myself, is helping people with their money. And so that brings me to another spinoff thing I wanted to ask you about, is that putting off the hard work, quote unquote, to the next day, if it's scrubbing the floor or if it's making a decision about your finances, help us understand why people do that. And I'm very curious as a financial planner, because sometimes I'll make very well-reasoned, logical, well-thought-out recommendations, build a whole financial plan for somebody, and then, you know, sometimes they go, yeah, and there's that putting it off kind of thing. What causes that?
So a lot of things cause that. I'll focus on two, and they're related. The core idea is something called present bias, which is that we put, let's say, about twice the weight on things that happen right now relative to things that happen in the future, which means that if I take an unpleasant task, for example, enrolling in my 401k plan. Now, I'm a pension geek, so for me, enrolling in a 401k plan is not unpleasant. But for most people, reading the fine print, going through the prospectus, learning about the details, all of that is stressful, boring, challenging, unpleasant. So I could either do it today, and I pay the full psychological price, or I can shift it to tomorrow. In which case, or next week or next month, and I pay a half psychological price.
Yeah, it's a 50% discount psychological price. So you just, instead of going in and paying full price, you pay half price by putting it off and never having to do the other half.
Well, you're going to do it in the future, but it just feels less bad.
Okay.
If I do it right now, I pay the full psychological price. If I move it into the future, it psychologically loses its negativity, not completely, but about half of it goes away. Now, of course, someday I'll reach that future point, and then I'm going to be there doing the action, suffering as I do it. But when I look ahead in time, let's say a month into the future, well, doing something unpleasant a month from now doesn't feel that bad to me right now, relative to doing it right now.
Okay, I'm with you now. Wow, boy. Don't we play games with ourselves, don't we?
Exactly. And that's exactly what we think about it. It's playing a game with yourself. It's thinking about your current self, thinking about your future self. So I'm going to tell my future self, you do the hard work. And my current self doesn't fully feel the pain.
I love it. Oh, my gosh. Well, okay, we've got lots to cover more here. David Leibson's our guest, ladies and gentlemen. A smart guy, and he's funny, too. Professor of Economics from Harvard. Stay right there. We'll take a quick break.
There are hundreds of annuities available in today's marketplace. How can you know if one is right for you? Certified financial planner David Holland answers this question and more in his educational booklet on annuities. To get your free copy, call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN. The annuity booklet provides a plain English explanation of the different types of annuities so you can decide if one is a good fit for your situation. Again, that number is 888-747-7526.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. David Leibson's our guest, professor of economics from Harvard, scholar.harvard.edu/Leibson, LAIBSON, if you want to get some more information. And we're talking about behavioral economics, 401k plans, biases, and the mind games we play with ourselves about making some tough decisions. So I've got to ask you this, David, because this is one that I've wondered about for a long time, and I have my own thoughts about it. But we talk about the present bias, and you talk about looking forward. Now let's go the other way. We all think back to, for example, you know, 2008 when the market dropped 37-38%, or we go back to 2000, 2001, 2002. How does our present bias affect our memories of those events? And as they get further away, do we have this natural tendency to say, well, it wasn't all that bad? I mean, in terms of some of the investment decisions we make today, because I've seen people come in and they have way too much money in the market. They're way too aggressive. They seem to be numb to what had happened in the past. They don't have those same feelings as they did before.
So there is something that's like present bias as we look backward in time. It's called recency bias. And the idea there is that what's happened recently, let's say in the last few years, weighs most heavily in our prediction of the future. So for example, if I'm in the midst of a rapidly falling market, say it's 2008, early 2009, and I look back over the last few years, I look at this real disaster in my portfolio, and when I look forward, I start to think, well, maybe that disaster will reproduce itself. And so my investing becomes more and more risk-averse or more skeptical of the stock market because I'm letting the last few years overwhelm my thinking. Now, that leads to something called return chasing, which is whatever happened recently, that's what I'm trying to strategize about in my portfolio looking forward.
And you actually have that expectation because of that recent bias.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that leads to a lot of bad decision making because it leads people, when the market is low, having fallen a lot recently, to get out of the market. And it leads people, when the market is very high, having gone up a lot recently, to pile into the market. And, well, first of all, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, the market's not very predictable.
Mm-mm.
So you shouldn't be trying to time the market in the first place. And in the second place, if anything, if there's any pattern in the market, it's probably that in the midst of a period when the market has fallen 50% in recent years, that's probably exactly the wrong time to be getting out of the market.
Exactly.
And likewise, when the market's gone up 100%, 200% in recent years, that's exactly the wrong time to be piling in even more. So to the extent there's any predictability, and again, I warn you, there's not much predictability, you probably want to be a contrarian, not a return chaser. So people's intuitions take them exactly in the wrong direction.
Yeah, that's very well put, David. And in fact, in the financial world, there's this, and a lot of people outside of that might not be aware of it, but the professional investors, investment managers, money managers, and such, actually look at what retail money's doing. They look at what retail investors are doing because very often they're wrong, and so then the professional investor takes the opposite position.
Exactly.
That when all of the retail investors are piling in, as you say, chasing the markets running up, they chase that run up, and they say, okay, it's time to get out because it's going to get overbought, and we're going to have a correction.
Yeah. So the first lesson that I would emphasize is, don't try to market time. It's really hard. Leave that to the professionals. They're going to get it wrong.
Exactly. Even they can't get it right. Yeah. You'll love this, David. In my office, I have a couple conference rooms, and I have three crystal balls, one in each conference room, and they all have a little sign on them, and it says, it has a nice, pretty crystal ball too, and it says, "Crystal ball broken. Financial planning required."
Yes.
Because
exactly.
you just can't predict what it's going to do.
Yeah.
All right, well, we can predict this. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back more with David Labeson, professor of economics at Harvard University. We'll be right back.
Sometimes I know what I want to say, but just can't find the words.
Last week I shouted at my grandson, and I'm not sure why.
I saw my daughter, but couldn't remember her name.
The sooner you recognize the warning signs of Alzheimer's disease, the sooner you can do something about it. To learn more, go to alz.org/10signs. That's alz.org/10signs. A message from the Alzheimer's Association.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. All right, I saved the best for last. We are going to talk in our final segment here, continuing our conversation with David Labeson, professor of economics at Harvard. And we're going to talk about something that a lot of times people overlook when it comes to investing or don't put enough emphasis on, and that's the subject of fees. And David, I know you have some thoughts about that. Why do people not pay enough attention to fees?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. The first is that people are return chasers, so they're focused on how well the asset did in the last year or two. And that little tiny management fee just doesn't loom very large compared to the 25% return in the last 12 months. But the problem is, of course, that 25% return in the last 12 months has almost no predictive power. By that I mean, historical returns don't reproduce themselves. In fact, if anything, there's probably a little bit of mean reversion, just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
What does reproduce itself is the fee.
Right.
So the high fee fund remains the high fee fund, whereas the high return fund is just as likely to be the low return fund next year as it is to be the high return fund.
I would take a dollar. That's very well. I take a dollar for every time I've heard somebody say, "Yeah, I know the fees are high on the investments I have right now, and I hear you've got maybe something better for me, but I don't care about the fee because it made me money."
Exactly. And that's exactly the wrong strategy. Those historical returns are not, on average, going to reproduce themselves.
That's why our entire industry says prior performance isn't necessarily indicative of future results. Actual results can and will vary, and you may incur a profit or loss.
Yes.
This is part of what I do, David, is I go in and I'll analyze somebody's portfolio. I do a lot of second opinions for people, and I'll find the fees. And a lot of times, there's two things. There's what you and I talked about. It just doesn't loom as large. And it's also just a complete ignorance. And I don't mean that in a judgmental sense that the person is dumb. It's just that they don't have any clue that there's a fee. In fact, some people even think that $50 they pay once a year for a custodial fee is all they pay. Why isn't there more interest in fees? Is it the same thing you talked about earlier?
Yeah, it's minuscule and it's hard to see. I mean, the first thing is it's only 1% of the assets in the account. That seems small. Of course, over time, that accumulates.
Absolutely.
1% every year over 50 years is 50% of your final balance if you're following a single portfolio through time with no new contributions. So it feels extremely small, and it's shrouded. By shrouded, I mean the industry is doing its best to make that fee either invisible or just very, very hard to see.
Well, they do both. They do both. You know, it's, and again, this is a little bit, you know, more detail than maybe some people care to hear, but, you know, mutual funds to create a daily valuation of their holdings, not so much for, you know, reporting or whatever, but so that they could apply the fee daily to the net value before the close, and out comes a fee on a daily basis, and you never see it.
Exactly. It's not on the quarterly report. Let me tell you a kind of amazing story about that. I called a major asset management company a few years ago about my wife's account at that company. And with the person on the phone, who I found out was serving that phone bank for many, many months, I asked, what is the expense ratio on this mutual fund? And the person, the representative of this mutual fund company on the phone, said to me, well, I'm looking at her account now, and I don't see any expenses on her quarterly statements. And they said, that means there is no fee.
Wow.
And I challenged them, and I prodded them, and I pushed them, and I explained, and they kept insisting there is no expense on this particular product. And then I asked them, well, how does the company make money? And the person on the phone said, well, we have other products that have fees, but this one doesn't have
any. My gosh.
Now, of course, this was nonsense. I knew exactly what was going
on. Sure.
This was someone who was so poorly trained, they didn't know the first thing about how a mutual fund works, which is that 0.5 percentage point or 1 percentage point fee. And if the representatives of the industry on the phone banks don't know it, not all of them, but apparently some of them, you can imagine how hard it is for the typical American investor.
Yeah, and the prospectuses don't help. The financial industry as a whole has done a poor job of explaining fees. When they're not trying to hide them, when they are trying to show them, they've done a poor job. And it doesn't have to be that complicated. Well, David, here's the bad news for the show is that we're out of time. I'd love to have you come back and talk more with us about this. David Lapson's our guest, ladies and gentlemen, professor of economics, Harvard University. David, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Want to learn more about Real Money with David Holland? Visit us at realmoneyradio.com, where you can listen live or to the archives. You can also email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to info@realmoneyradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at Real Money with David Holland, and keep up with Scott Connor by following us on Twitter at Real Money Radio.
Remember, nobody cares more about your money than you do. This has been Real Money with David Holland. Thank you for listening.